So, welcome indeed, and I think you'll all agree that this is a particularly significant Versopolis gathering, as I may be making clear with my badges. This one's homemade for the occasion. So I don't need to say any more because we're all very aware of things that have happened. So first of all, some little formal announcements. In the event of fire or overexcitement after some of the readings, the exit is there through that door. And I think that's all I have to say on. Oh, and one at the back. And then very importantly, enormous thanks to the sponsors of this event, namely Arts Council England and Versopolis and the Creative Europe program of the EU, of the European Union, and very especially someone who is actually in this room, Viv Arscott. Thank you very much indeed. So thanks for the sponsorship. Very, very briefly, my involvement with Versopolis is essentially in the editing and producing of these little parallel text books, and I've had enormous fun working with the five continental poets on the texts and exactly how we ordered and produced everything. So very creative exchanges have been going on for months. And so these five, I feel I know as old friends, and the four British Versopolis poets who are here today, I'm welcoming very much as new good friends. So we're going to start, please, with Andrei Rudolph.
Hello, nice to meet you all here. Thank you, Glenn. I'm from Germany, from Leipzig in Germany. I had some wonderful native speaker help pronouncing the English versions of my poems, so I think it will be okay. I hope so. Nocturne for Jesse Tor. I was in touch with a saint in high Polish shoes. He let his feet carry him with dignity. He cleared his bowels at dawn with dignity. That's the kind of guy he was. Dead magpies fell from his shoulders when he shrugged. He rubbed his dick against the walls of buildings when it itched and smelled of fresh sperm and rosemary like a king. That's the kind of guy he was. The tame buildings whipped up the parting of his hair until he laughed. The sides of the triangles went red when he did it to them. That's the kind of guy he was. Breakneck, insomniac, and expressive, as he hurried past me and gave me his blessing, saying, "Eat up your pizza, honey, and die." So this poem is actually in honor of the Austrian poet Jesse Tor. Jesse Tor used to compose quite childish rhymes in his last poems. The translator decided not to translate not to give his translation such a rhyme structure, but I'll read it now in German, so maybe you will hear the rhymes. Nocturne für Jesse Tor. Ich hatte Kontakt zu einem Heiligen in hohen, fettglänzenden Schuhen. Er ließ sich von seinen Füßen tragen in Würde. Er entleerte sich in der Früh in Würde. So war er. Die toten Amseln fielen von seinen Schultern, wenn er sich zuckte. Er rieb seinen Schwanz an den Mauern der Häuser, wenn es ihn juckte, und roch nach frischem Sperma und Rosmarin wie ein König. So war er. Die zahmen Häuser peitschten seinen Scheitel auf, bis er lachte. Die Schenkel der Triangeln glühten, wenn er es ihnen machte, so war er rasend schnell und schlaflos und expressiv. Als er mich im Vorübergehen segnete und sagte, iss deine Pizza, Herzchen, und stirb. True Troy lies inside. Once, during one of those states of siege we plunge our bodies into through copious cocktail abuse, as if we were seafarers or whores, and not just in our dreams, you became so approachable it made my eyes bleed. The town lay as peaceful as ever and didn't even notice its bombardment. Whole streets had been wiped out. We were the only ones to see it. But we were trapped and waited for it to pass. Then fresh life bubbled up from the severed heads of the hydrants, flooding just everything. Chris, you remember how we went outside, you with your peculiar head and me with a pair of bunny ears. But we made it through. The lanterns bent down to us with their crooked necks, placid dinosaurs. They ate the light from our hands. And I told you I'd started meditating to stop the lethal nervousness that controls the whole of my life. Hello. My inner wolfishness has booked a taster course. That's why I'm writing. I'm selling commemorative medals of intuition. Yesterday, I slapped the kids on my head, followed up by a pain in my neck, shoulder, and heart. It was no joke. Yesterday, the kids buried 2 coins, Swedish krona, in the garden, for the treasure hunters, a theme reigning into my poem, so I provided with a hood. Now it has stopped raining, but my shoes are wet. My inner wolfishness, which is part of my name, I think, is howling. Yes, I can hear it distinctly howl. This poem will definitely be my ruin, I sense, eventually. Very gently, with a little timidity, I move towards the threshold of my demise. Death isolates itself with drywall and polystyrene. How different, in contrast, wolfishness. This heavy stuff of my ears, which I still have to carry. I have already reported about my anxiety. Constantly, I believe it will all collapse soon with a bang. But it doesn't. Some pedal sound, the suicide in the movie of my life drags a leg, waving, brooding, starlings in the birdhouse, cherry snatchers, that's it. A very hazardous idea of freedom that you bear, it says. Later on, some beer again for a leaf, that is no joke either. The fridge sings, wolfishness sings, my spouted cup trembles. Or it's me spouting, who knows. I know you would love to know more about my kids now. Kids are calming. Nothingness is very calming. Polishing phrases won't dry up the shoes, methinks. They are red. I once found them on the streets. Once, yes. Pedal wheel, by the way, not pedal. Something for the ghosts. Today the ghosts had loads of sleep and a full breakfast before they set out for their ways through our bodies. Mum, Dad, you were so clever to hide in 2 donuts. Although I had just bought you, you tasted tough and dry, hard to swallow, to tell the truth. But then we arrived at the jam where reconciliation could take place. Actually, it's something quite simple, I want to say. Clara, for example, is now thinking about her new German teacher, whom she can't stand and can't get out of her head. Sometimes they simply vanish with a coffee, or I don't know how they manage it, or for a moment they rustle the newspaper to distract us, before the ghosts again set out on their way through our bodies, and we don't see them all day long, and we do stand up from the table, put our shoes on, tighten our jackets, and leave the house, us and the children, each in a different direction. Thank you.
Very good. Wonderful. Is this working? Yeah. And beautifully read in English, Andre. Thank you. And particularly marvelous last poem, I think. Just before I ask Kim to come up onto the stage, I should just tell you that we're having five poets read in the first half, and then there will be a half-hour interval in case anyone gets anxious by then, and then the last four after the half-hour interval. So you, Pamela, are you puzzled by that?
Yeah, I'm puzzled by the half
hour. Well, that's the arrangement. Yeah. but we can arrange little informal readings around the hall during the half hour. So, Kim Moore, please, let's welcome Kim.
Hello, I'm really happy I'm following Andre, because my first poem's got a wolf in, and the inner wolfishness of the last one, the previous one. My people. I come from people who swear without realising they're swearing. I come from scaffolders and plasterers and shoemakers and carers. The type of carers paid pence per minute to visit an old lady's house. Some of my people have been inside a prison. Sometimes I tilt towards them and see myself reflected back. If they were from Yorkshire, which they're not, but if they were, they would have been the ones on the picket shouting scab and throwing bricks at policemen. I come from a line of women who get married twice. I come from a line of women who bring up children and men who go to work. If I knew who my people were in the time before women were allowed to work, they were probably the women who were working anyway. If I knew who my people were before women got the vote, they would not have cared about the vote. There are many arguments among my people. Nobody likes everybody. In the time of slavery, my people would have had them if they were the type of people who could afford them, which they probably weren't. In the time of casual racism, some of my people would and will join in. Some of my people know everybody who lives on their street. They are the type of people who will argue with the teacher if their child has detention. The women of my people are wolves, and we talk to the moon in our sleep. So I don't normally read this poem this far south in case my family hear it. But they're all in Leicester, so I think I'm fairly safe here. And after saying my people are the type of people who argue with the teacher if their child has detention, I then became a music teacher for 13 years. So I kind of saw it from the other side. So I'm going to read a poem about... Actually, I'm going to read two poems about teaching, because... but the first one, the type of teaching I do, the whole class gets a trumpet, a cornet or a baritone, and we all make beautiful music together. I should say it's a class of normally 7 to 8-year-olds. And the teacher is supposed to learn as well, so the teacher gets a trumpet, cornet or a baritone, and they're supposed to sit in the class and learn. If you've been a teacher, you'll know how often that happens. They normally kind of collapse into a corner at the back and try and recover. So this is my kind of list of all the terrible things that have happened to me as a trumpet teacher over the years. The trumpet teacher's curse. A curse on the children who tap the mouthpiece with the heel of their hand to make a popping sound, who drop the trumpet on the floor, then laugh. A darker curse on those who fall with the trumpet in their hands and selfishly save themselves. A curse on the boy who dropped a pencil on the bell of his trombone to see if it did what I said it would. A curse on the girl who stuffed a pom-pom down her cornet and then said it was her invisible friend who did it. A curse on the class teacher who sits at the back of the room and does her paperwork. A curse on the teacher who says, "I'm rubbish at music," in a loud enough voice for the whole class to hear. A curse on the father who coated his daughter's trumpet valves with Vaseline because he thought it was a thing to do. A curse on the boy who threw up in his baritone as if it was his own personal bucket. Let them be plagued with the urge to practice every day without improvement. Let them play in concerts each weekend which involve marching and outdoors and coldness. Let their family be forced to give up their Saturdays listening to bad music in village halls. Or spend their Sundays at the bandstand. Them, one dog and the drunk who slept there the night before, taking up the one and only bench. God's, let it rain. So all the things in that poem are true, except I changed the gender of the children because that's the kind of responsible teacher that I am. And I often try my poems out on my mum and dad because they're not into poetry at all. And I ring them up and say the poem to them on the phone, and my mum just went, "Well, that was my life," which I thought was harsh. I'm trying to avoid talking about the R word. I'm trying to be in a poetry bubble, but I can't resist reading my my Dear Mr. Gove poem because I think we need it on a day like today. So there's a whole kind of genre of Dear Mr. Gove material. I read Michael Rosen used to do a letter, didn't he, Dear Mr. Gove, in the newspapers, and I thought I'd do my own kind of letter. So I think that last poem makes me sound like a terrible teacher, whereas this one is probably too much the other way. I sound a bit angelic, which is fine by me, but this is Dear Mr. Gove. And I know that, that it's out of date because he's not the education secretary anymore, obviously. He was moved to the Justice Department by the time the book went to print. Where could he do more damage than, oh, Prime Minister? So it is kind of out of date, but it's, yeah. Dear Mr. Gove. Dear Mr. Gove, today I taught the children not to sit like bags of small potatoes in their chairs. I taught them how to breathe with their bellies like babies do when they are sleeping. We pretended we were balloons of different colours filling up with air. Dear Mr. Gove, we played long note beat that. We looked up who holds the world record for the longest note. It was a clarinet player who managed to play for 1 minute and 13 seconds without taking a breath. We held our note as if we were monks singing a drone in a cathedral where the roof rises like a giant wing against the sky. Dear Mr. Gove, today the whole class played hot cross buns. We talked about the great height of the note E. We held thin blue straws between our lips, and some of us went on to play an E, and some of us fell towards low A, with its ledger line hovering above it, and another piercing its poor head. Dear Mr. Gove, we are brilliant at trying. Some of us know what crotchets and minims are, and we will know this all our lives, but some of us still call them black and white. White notes. We make up sayings to help us read, like elephants go bananas doing flips, like electric green brains dance forever. We play the riff to Eye of the Tiger and sing along in the voices of tigers if tigers had voices like ours. Today, Mrs. Johnson forgot how to play a D, and Harry told her which valves to press. I do not know how to measure this. Mr. Gove, please send help. And there is also the problem of Matthew, who cannot read or write too well, but who can play Mary Had a Little Lamb with perfect pitch. There is the problem of his smile afterwards, and how we write this down. Today we watched the Muppets singing Bohemian Rhapsody for no good reason other than that it was fun. And while I am confessing small transgressions, last week we watched Mr. Bean play an invisible drum kit. The children have been playing an invisible drum kit in the playground. Dear Mr. Gove, I did not stop them. Today we talked about the muscles in the lip and tongue. We did not know we had control of so many muscles. We tried to look like musicians. Mr. Gove, please help us. I'm just checking the time. Yeah. So I'm just going to read two more poems. The title poem of my book, which is, the book's kind of got lots of falling all the way through it, kind of physical falling and psychological falling, and famous people that have fallen in different. Well, they're not really famous; they're kind of obsessive people that have fallen. But I'm going to read the title poem, which is just my obsession with the word and how it has negative and positive connotations in English. The Art of Falling. This is for falling, which is so close to failing, or to falter or fill. As in, I faltered when I heard you were here. As in, I filtered you out of my life. As in, I've had my fill of falling. A fall from grace, a fall from God. To fall in love or to fall through the gap. Snowfall, rainfall, falling stars, the house falls into disrepair, to fall in with the wrong crowd, to fall out of love, to fall like Jessica who fell down a well and watched the bright disk of the sun and moon slowly passing. For twins who start so close together they must fall apart for the rest of their lives or be damned. To fall down a hill like a brother, to follow like a sister, to be a field and fall fallow, to fall pregnant, for vertigo, the cousin of falling, for towers and stairs and pavements, which are the agents of falling, for the white cliff top of a bed, for climbers and roofers and gymnasts, for the correct way to fall, loose-limbed and floppy, to fall apart after death, for ropes and fences and locks which carry the act of falling inside, for fall which over the ocean means autumn, which means leaves like coins of different colours dropped from the pockets of trees, which means darker evenings, which means walks with the dogs, which means walking alone and not falling apart at the sound of your name, which, God help me, sounds like falling. So I'm just going to read one new poem to finish off. I've been working on this this sequence of poems called All the Men I Never Married, and I'm aiming for 20. And it started off just kind of as a bit of fun, like thinking about past relationships, and then I got really obsessed with it, as you do. And then I started writing poems about any man that I kind of came across. I just thought, well, he could be in All the Men I Never Married. He can go in the sequence. So there's a few people looking slightly uncomfortable now. they acted, you know, it wasn't just a complete random. Often they'd annoyed me in some way. So I was like, right, I'll write them a poem. But this poem's either going to be first or last in the sequence. I can't decide where to put it. So thank you for listening. And I forgot to say, I'm really happy to be part of the Vesopolis project. I went to Croatia last year and met Goran over there, so it's nice to see him here. So this is All the Men I Never Married. They're all just going to be numbered as well. They're not going to have any names or anything. It's just going to be number one, number two, number three. So this is number one or 20. All the Men I Never Married. There was the boy who I met on the park who tasted of humbugs and wore a mustard yellow jumper, and the kickboxer with beautiful long brown hair that he tied with a band at the nape of his neck. and the one who had a constant ear infection, so I sat always on his left. And the guy who worked in an office and could only afford to fill up his car with £2 worth of petrol. And the trumpet player I loved from the moment I saw him, dancing to the Rolling Stones. The guy who smoked weed and got more and more paranoid, whose fingers flickered and danced when he talked. The one whose eyes were two pieces of winter sky. The music producer, long-legged and full of opinions, and more trumpet players, one who was too short and not him, and one who was too thin and not him. Are you judging me yet? Are you surprised? Let me tell you of the ones I didn't touch, or who didn't touch me. The trombonist I went drinking with, how we lay twice a week in each other's beds like two unlit candles. We were not for each other, and in this we were wise. We were only moving through the world together for a time. There was a poet whose soul poured from his mouth like a dark mess, a double bassist who stood behind me and angled the body of his bass into mine and shadowed my hands on its neck. And all I could feel was heat from his skin and the lightest breath. And even this might have been imagined. I want to say to them now, though all we are to each other is ghosts, once you were all that I thought of. When I whisper your names, it isn't a curse or a spell or a blessing. I'm not mourning your passing or calling you here. This is something harder, like walking alone in the dusk and the leaves. This is the naming of trees. This is a series of flames. This is watching you all disappear. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was a beautiful reading. Thank you, Ken. And now, Monica Sprung, please come to the stage. If you can detect a particular warmth in my pronunciation of Monica's name, it's because I am actually a fellow Norwegian. So.
Hello, and thank you for having me. I'm Norwegian, and I live in Stockholm. And I can comfort you, it's not so bad outside the European Union, as you might think. There are some possibilities in it, I think, beyond the propaganda. And I read from a collection called An Invented Child. I invented a child. It doesn't give me peace. I see it being carried. I see it being carried, bloody and born. Jeg diktet et barn. Det gir meg ikke fred. Jeg ser det bli båret. Jeg ser det bli båret, blodig og født. I shall tell you the fairy tale you're so fond of. That of the fire. I met the fire in the forest. The fire saw me and looked at me with blazing eyes. It came closer and closer, and the warmth warmed, and the arms were yellow, its face red. It stops and asks, "Will you come with me into the forest? Come with me through the trees, through the grass, across the field I go, under the earth," said the fire, with a mouth full of bark and its voice full of flowers. And I joined it on its journey, walked beside it in the dark. "I'll show the way," said the fire. Jeg skal fortelle deg det eventyret du liker så godt. Det om ilden. Jeg møtte ilden i skogen. Ilden så meg og så på meg med skinnende øyne. Den kom nærmere og nærmere, og varmen varmet fra armene gule, ansiktet rødt. Den stopper og spør, Blir du med mig in i skogen? Bli med mig genom träna, genom gräset, bort över marka ska jag, under jorden, sa elden, med munnen full av bark och stämmen full av blomster. Och jag slår följe med den vidare, gick vid sidan av den i mörke. Jag visar väg, sa elden. I give you tears that sprout. You shall use them when someone forces themselves inside. Then you shall let that crying sprout. Let the crying dance on the very edge like the bullets in a fountain. Then I give you tears that sob. They come over you when you least expect them and are difficult to stop. I give you a brother to hate, and you get the violence as part of siblinghood. Jag ger dig en bror att hata, och vålden får det som en del av syskenskapet. There's no room for you in the picture, I say. You must walk yourself on your legs. Det är inte plats till dig i bilden, säger jag. Du må gå själv på dina ben. I drag around the blood of all feet. That's why, says the child. No, I say, that can't be right. Must be something else, a smaller burden. Perhaps a shattered hate. You can try to heal that. You receive a letter which is so flat that it's nearly empty. So white and flat that it cuts itself into you, and red. Into your eye, tightens your throat, turns your stomach inside out. Stop, says the child. I don't want this letter. Yes, I say. It's already written. It's already on its way into your eye. Gas for the lamp, did you remember? Said the child. And blood for the fur. You gave me a lamp of silver. No. An ocean it was. An ocean. The column of the black or the back in water. The nail's power unfolds. Hair. The wound and the fur for the dog. Glass for the bell jar. Glass flax for the pig. Flat in the floor. It's not so easy, I say, to breed a face. I search in the soil for images. I search in the water that runs. I search for something to show you. You have my smile, I say. My smile, only bigger. It rises up in an enormous bow from ear to ear, then it lowers itself downwards like a belly towards the earth and rises again up. It grows so tall that it mixes with the sky. The face cracks, the chin falls off, but the eyes still keep together, and the brow and the nose like a tree, but the meat has fallen off, and the skull. It carries skin like a word. This tree, it glides slowly across the sky, without veins, without meat, freely, until it runs into something that's just as white as a skull. The devil cattle, there walk the devil cattle walk on the sky glacier. The white cattle, the heifer grazes on the sky glacier. When the devil cattle lows, the glacier cracks, I say. I look at the child. It stands still. Shall we walk on, I ask. Shall we put on warm clothes and walk on? The child doesn't answer. Come, I say. Come, take the cape. Don't ask, I say. Just walk. Walk. And we walk. And it carries ties as it should, the knee and the calf in the snow road, flat, countries, snow on the knee, knee, knee. Down into the snow kneels, trampled, trampled on for so long to the knees, hip, catches firmly screwed. Now we have eyeballs in the sky tree, I say. Not everyone has that, has something like this. They grow in the light. We won't give up, I say to the child, until we've written our names into the church books and out of our own history. But now we'll keep walking. Forget a letter. It's no easy way, this. There are the devil cattle. Do you see up there? White loins. The bell is whiteness. Eats the glacier. White, whiten, said the child. White, whiten. Stop, hi, white, said the child. White, devil cattle. Eat the glacier. Eat the snow. White, they low. Eat the whiteness. Topple over. Sated by white. Sated and whiter. Colder and white. Stop, I say. Finish. White is the sheet. White is the wood, the cloth white, the word white, the pain whitens, the child laughs, the chalk white, teeth, chalk, hide, bite. It laughs, the eyes white, in bits white, weeping the child laughs, dips, the eyes whiter, sleep white sun, it whitens, crooked, hole, line, flakes. Stop, I say to the child. No, you must stop, I say, before it's too late, before the snow makes traces in the air. They can never be removed. Now they stand there forever. I shall eat you alive. I shall do that for you, if you will be my mother, if you're offering living eyes. Living eyes, eyes in the veins, eyes in the skull, fat, whole ice caresses, alive. The light of an eye, dark of a mouth, blood of a nose, lips. I conjure up the face mask. I carry it heavily. I strike it, if needs be. Crush it if I must. I have tools to wipe out all human features. I know the eye sockets inside out. The gaze is full of stamps. It shows where you've been. If there is a stamp you want to hide, then be shifty-eyed or sleep with open or closed eyes. Your gaze is stamped at all borders. Every time you cross the border, I say to the child, whether they are your own borders or those of others. You can frighten another with the fear in your eyes, I say. You laugh. The screwy laughter of yours gets on my nerves. But you said I should use the laughter crying. That time you gave me vocal cords as hard as boards. No, I say. You're wrong. You must be thinking of the fountain tears. But you said that I should weep with the laughter, that I should get a crying that was a laughter. No, I never said that. Thank you.
Tusen tak, thank you very much. Indeed, Monica. Very beautiful. So, Daljeet, please come to the stage.
Thank you. Thank you, Glenn. Only my mum says Daljeet. Everyone else says Daljeet.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But as far, I'm very honoured, mother. I'm going to call you mum from now on.
Have you got a clean handkerchief and have you got a clean handkerchief and everything?
Yeah, thank you, Mum. I'm going to read a couple of passages from my version of the Ramayana, so the 2,000, 3,000-year-old Indian text, in the spirit of collaboration. So I went, to Asia To do this thing. And the story varies in India. There's different versions of the story in India. There's a different version of it in Thailand, Malaysia, Philippines, Burma, Laos. They all have different versions of the story. Isn't that interesting? There is no one definitive story of it. And there's a Hindu version, Jain version, a few Hindu versions. And there's a Sikh version as well. The 10th Guru did a version of it for Sikhism. So I've just put together a kind of mix of various things and various languages or various Englishes. The basic story is, you know, girl meets boy. She gets abducted by this supposed demon, and then the husband has to go into battle to win her back. So it's about Rama and Sita. And the demon Ravana, in North India, he's a baddie. He's an all-out baddie. In Southern India, he's a hero. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? So in my prologue, I did a little prologue about Ravana. I present him as a baddie, but later on I sort of warm up to him a bit. It's a sort of act of going south, I guess, as we often do. So this is basically the gods have gone to complain to Vishnu, who is the, you know, top god in my version, about this Ravana is becoming powerful. So I'll read this bit, a little bit of it. So it's called Get Ravana. Lord of the cosmos, Vishnu was brought back to heaven from a stellar meditation by many gods now stooped at his feet. Said one, semi-stooped in the saffron light, O Lord, whilst we in thousand-day prayers for peace are bent, Ravana is bishboshing our kingdoms. No wonder the gods were gurgling with collywobbles. Ravana was toasting their earthly and galactic worlds. But who was this scallywag, this Gunda? Lord of the cosmos, Vishnu, flashed umpteen visions to the gods that showed Ravana's path to glory. In the first flashback, Vishnu displayed Ravana being born with 10 heads and 10 pairs of arms. Then he showed Ravana, the teenager, on a hillock, meditating for so many non-stop years that smoke was issuing from his head and dulling the heavens. No surprise, in Vishnu's next vision, Ravana was losing his mind and was holding a blade to cut off his own 10 heads. Vishnu from on high stopped him by asking what he is wanting. Ravana boomed back, Am I not a worthy king of the universe, Lord? Vishnu must have hoped Ravana would become pure Shanti, a bit like himself. Yet soon as Vishnu's divine engine touched across each Ravana atom in a somewhat unparalleled way, Ravana went bonkers. His 10 heads, his 10 sets of arm, trapezoid, rump, knuckle and whatnot juddered tsunami volcanically into a hardcore fierce firming up. His every millionth was muscling, pinnacling with indestructibility-ness. Okay, thank you. I'm going to move on from that. I'll read a nice gentle bit of Rama and Sita first meet. I thought I'd do a nice quiet bit for this. I can't find it now. I found it's kind of a version that's about 1,000 years old. And in that version, when they first meet, she's up in a kind of, you know, balcony, and he's down here. So I thought I'd take that, because I've seen that somewhere before. So I thought, it's a good idea, isn't it? I love that kind of spatial thing. You get that in loads of stories, don't you? It's great. So I'll just read, I'll read that bit. Should I do a bit more? I'll do my toe rings bit, because I went to the Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology in my research, and they've got loads of toe rings there from, you know, early Indian traditions. And they've got loads of packs of 10 toe rings, because in very traditional setups, you'd wear a different toe ring for each toe. Okay? So you've got 10 toe rings, but you have to pick the right toe ring for the personality of that toe. Isn't that cute? And part of the thing, in some of the versions of Ravana, no, you're not supposed to look beyond the legs at the lady. So when Sita gets abducted, the monkeys are told of how her toes look, how her feet look. So you have to kind of find her by looking for her feet. I didn't do that in my version. That would be just, that wouldn't work, would it? It's too nuts. Anyway, I'll do that. So this is Rama and Lakshmana's his brother. Rama and Lakshmana, so they turn up at this lovely place where Sita lives. So Rama and Lakshmana fanning their gaze on swings strapped to trees, swaying with couples. And nearby the girls wore a length of kashmir cotton that whirled about the body and pointed to the S-type anklets and pointed to the bell-topped toe ring on each toe. Each toe ring specially designed to suit that toe's darling mien. And speaking a while longer of toe rings, some girls wore the cheeky come-on rings that were double-bosomed and filled with a tinsy knocker, dingling its own tantalising tune. Hi, hi. What's more, all girls strode about wondrously barefooted, all rehearsed love tunes or danced to soft gom-goms. No wonder Rama and Lakshmana smiled to the music of their hooting, their panting. And there, whilst by the stream, Rama's eyes lifted upwards, and there, across on a balcony, from where the cool breeze blew off the balmy sea, a woman in shining Corsium silk, with a spotted deer border, and with eyes brilliant as the lotus, and with her feet all of a sudden rooted, so she looked the double of the goddess Lakshmi. Rama's second take on, who is that? Is that the beauty of the world across on the balcony, observing the jamboree? And her eyes fell, according to the exact second of the cosmic dial that we call fate, on Rama's eyes, at the same time as Rama's had flown startled upon hers. Their heartbeats doubled on the same count and hearkened in a shared breath. The hearkening damsel was Sita. While Rama dazed at her beauty, Sita dazed at his and thought to herself how this must be the veiled recognition that we call love at first sight. Together they had walked eon after eon, fresh as bold new lovers, under the starry lanes in heaven, he as Vishnu and she as Lakshmi. 'Twas in this incarnation, under all the depredations a human endures, an elapsed memory being amongst our most humbling torments, through which each looked upon the other a stranger. Okay, I'm going to read an extract of a poem now from my pen poet, on a very serious note. So it's an Eritrean poet, Emmanuel Asrat. So he was the editor-in-chief of The Times, or what's called Zeman, the Eritrean paper. And his reward was to be, you know, arrested, just taken one morning in September 2001, you know, part of the state crackdown. He's been sort of locked up. Without trial ever since, okay? And he's in a maximum security prison, in a place. I'm going to spell the name of it. This is even it's really spooky. I'll spell the name of this place: E-I-R-A-E-I-R-O. Isn't that scary? If you're locked up in a place like that. Anyway, I can read a little passage of his long. It's a really long poem. It's called War's Curse. So I'll read a little section of it. So War's Curse. Something growled, something boomed, invading the calm. It echoed, stuck. Where two brothers pass by each other, where two brothers meet, where two brothers join in the piazza of life and death, in the gulf between calamity and culture, in the valley of anxiety and peace, something boomed. While the Kaya and Sarah acacias spat at each other, sorghum and millet cut each other down. With no one to collect them, they feed on one another until a single seed remains, brimming with tears, being chopped, hacked, sowed unto itself, planted in earth, yet to gush in that indiscernible thing, stream of blood and water, the seed assailed by the freezing sun, tempestuous nimbus cloud, greyish lightning, scalding rain, slipping through littered iron, climbing onto the spirit of death, shouldering its sterile life. Here it has grasped at spring. Grasped at spring. Okay, thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
Very much, Daddy. You pushed out the walls and lifted the roof. Thank you very much. And now, Samantha bounce. I must just say that when I asked Samantha how to pronounce her name, I assumed it was Samantha, because she's reading from French. The poems in the Versopolis book are all originally French, but you will discover she is far more international than that, and that is why she's called Samantha.
In fact, I'm a French poet from Lyon in France, but I'm half Argentinian, half Italian. I was born in Spain, and I grew up in Mexico. And I will ask an half Indian and British poet to read the English version of my French poetry. Thank you for being there. Thank you for that, Glenn. Starting with train. Mean trains. Le paysage défile comme un Jackson Pollock, vaches en pointillé, nuages étirés, taches tournesol et rails déformés. La fenêtre froide se colle à mon oreille et j'entends tatac-tater la bête humaine. Tatac-tatoum.
Scenes unravel like a Jackson Pollock. Caldos, stretched clouds. Sunflower patches and deformed tracks. The cold window sticks to my ear, and I can hear the tack, tack, tack of the human beast.
Tatac tatoum, tatac tatoum, tatac tatoum. Je ne suis pas Eva Marie Saint, je n'ai ni la mort aux trousses, ni les baisers de Cary Grant. Il n'y a derrière la vitre que ces paysages de cartes postales, cette campagne d'avant-guerre, ces empreintes ferroviaires. Une vache, un château, une église, un âne, une vieille mobilette ou un train à la retraite, de l'herbe à perte de vue, des champs de coquelicots, un village suspendu, la dame blanche, un mouton ou peut-être une chèvre, un autre coquelicot, une jupe en corolle, une canette de soda, un plastique, une poubelle, un néon, un flash. Tatac tatoum.
I am not Eva Maria Saint. I'm not going north by northwest, and Cary Grant is not kissing me. All I can see behind these glass panes are pictured postcard scenes. Pre-war countryside, railway prints, a cow, a castle, a church, a donkey, an old motorcycle, or a disused train. Grass as far as the eye can see. Poppy fields, a village on the hills, the white lady, a sheep, maybe a goat, a single poppy, a flared skirt, a fizzy drink, a piece of plastic, a bin, a neon light, a flash.
Tatac tatoum, tatac tatoum, tatac tatoum, tatac tatoum. Je ne suis pas Celia Johnson dans Brève rencontre à attendre jeudi prochain, jeudi prochain, jeudi prochain. Les amours interdites dans un petit café. Il n'y a derrière la glace que d'amers paysages qui se répètent et défilent et reviennent et repassent et tournent et recommencent et les vaches se ressemblent et la neige dissimule le pas des loups, des ogres et des sorcières.
I am not Celia Johnson in Brief Encounter, waiting for next Thursday. Next Thursday? Next Thursday's Forbidden Loves in a little cafe. All I can see behind this window pane are bitter landscapes going round and round and on, and cows look like cows, and the snow hides every trace of wolf, ogre, and witch.
Tatac tatoum, tatac tatoum, tatac tatoum, tatac tatoum. Je ne suis pas Marilyn Monroe dans certains lèmes chauds. Il n'y a devant mes yeux que d'immenses pâtis, rocailles et herbes folles que les cornes ébahies ruminent méthodiquement. Tatac.
I am not Marilyn Monroe in Some Like It Hot. All I can see are immense mounds, rock gardens and weeds, which astonished horns methodically ruminate.
Défile les kilomètres, le nord est encore loin, 105,8, nous arriverons demain.
The kilometers add up, the north is still a long way away, 105.8, we'll get there tomorrow.
This one is called El Vuelo de la Muerte. It was written in Spanish before. So now it's Le Vol de la Mort, the theft of death. And it's depressing. Si bleu, le calme bleu des ondes irrégulières, paysage de carte postale. Mais dans les tréfonds des mers et des mémoires, des corps encore adolescents, endormis, meurtris, se décomposent en 76 anonymement. Les avions militaires strient le ciel de coton blanc. Comme des aigles, ils disparaissent dans le trouble firmament. Et naissent los desaparecidos. Ce n'est pas bleu, c'est plus que du bleu. C'est tellement bleu que ça en devient turquoise, presque vert. Et on a beau chercher des synonymes azurés, rien ne colle à cette immensité bleutée. Rien n'égale les reflets célestes de l'étendue marine et rien n'atteint les profondeurs céruléennes des marées incertaines. Mais ce n'est pas bleu, c'est plus que du bleu. C'est un mélange de myosotis, d'émeraude, de lapis-lazuli, un bleu plus bleu que la couleur de tes yeux, plus bleu qu'un monochrome de clin, plus bleu qu'une vague d'okusai. Mais ce n'est pas bleu, c'est plus que du bleu. C'est un bleu de mer et de mémoire, c'est un bleu noirci par les corps jetés d'hélicoptères, c'est un bleu teinté de disparition, c'est un bleu criminel, c'est un bleu coupable, c'est un rouge.
So blue, the blue beauty of calm and irregular waves, a postcard scenery. But in the depths of seas and memories, teenagers' bodies are asleep, bruised and broken down in 1976, anonymously. Military aircraft streak the cotton sky like eagles. They disappear in the blurred firmament. Desparecidos start to miss. It is not bleu. It is more than bleu. It is so blue that it becomes turquoise, almost green. And there are no azure synonyms. Nothing sticks to this blue-tinted immensity. Nothing beats the celestial reflections in the seascape. And nothing reaches the cerulean depths of uncertain tides. But it is not blue. It is more than blue. It is a mixture of forget-me-not, emerald, and lapis lazuli. It is bluer than the anger in your blue eyes. Bluer than a Klein monochrome. Bluer than a Hokusai wave. But it is not blue. It is more than blue. It is a blue of sea and memory. A blue blackened by bodies thrown from helicopters. It is a blue tinted with disappearances. A criminal blue. A guilty blue. A red.
Is that funny? So now the 30 things to do before you die. 1. Faire une liste de 35 autres choses à faire avant de mourir.
1. Make a list of other 35 things to do.
2. Ne pas mourir avant d'avoir fini la liste.
2. Do not die before the end of the list.
3. Regardez la carte.
3. Check the map.
4. Préparez les valises.
4. Prepare your luggage.
5. Prévoir des pulls.
5. Do not forget your pullovers.
6. Prévoir aussi des maillots de bain.
6. Do not forget your swimming costume.
7. Vider le compte en banque.
7. Clear and close your bank account.
8. Transférer le courrier.
8. Redirect your mail.
9. Enregistrer un message sur le répondeur.
9. Record a message on the answering machine.
10. Prendre une douche.
10. Take a shower.
11. Laver la voiture.
11. Wash the car.
12. Prendre de l'essence.
12. Buy petrol.
13. Vérifier la pression des pneus.
13. Check the tire pressures.
14. Acheter des cookies.
14. Buy some cookies.
15. Remplir des bouteilles d'eau.
15. Fill your water bottle.
16. Faire pipi.
Have a pee, number 16.
17. Vider le frigo.
17. Empty the fridge.
18. Arroser les plantes.
18. Do not forget to water the plants.
19. Porter le chat chez la voisine.
19. Ask your neighbor to sit the cat.
20. Vider la litière du chat.
20. Empty the litter tray.
21. Jeter les fleurs.
21. Throw out the old flowers.
22. Sortir les poubelles.
22. Take out the rubbish.
23. Finir la vaisselle.
23. Wash the dishes.
24. Ranger le linge.
24. Fold laundry.
25. Couper le gaz.
25. Switch off gas.
26. Couper l'eau.
26. Switch off water.
27. Éteindre les lumières.
27. Turn off the lights.
28. Fermer la porte à clé.
28. Lock the door.
29. Mettre les valises dans le coffre.
29. Put your luggage in the boot of your car.
30. Faire un dernier point.
30. Check the situation.
31. Couper le téléphone portable.
31. Switch off the mobile phone.
32. Mettre les lunettes de soleil.
32. Put on your sunglasses.
33. Allumer une clope.
33. Light a cigarette.
34. Prendre la route.
34. Drive away.
35. Ne pas faire demi-tour.
35. Do not back down.
Et vivre.
Live.
Let's do it. Écrire, c'est attendre. Écrire, c'est attendre que ça vienne. Écrire, c'est dépendre de quand ça viendra. Écrire, c'est se dire que ça ne viendra plus. Écrire, c'est se demander si ça reviendra un jour. Écrire, c'est regarder la page blanche. Écrire, c'est fermer l'ordinateur et retourner devant la télé. Écrire, c'est regarder la page blanche. Écrire, c'est fermer l'ordinateur et prendre un truc à manger dans le réfrigérateur. Écrire, c'est regarder la page blanche. Écrire, c'est tourner en cage et aller lire pour oublier. Écrire, c'est attendre. Écrire, c'est douter. Écrire, c'est penser que les prochaines lignes ne seront jamais aussi bonnes que les dernières. Écrire, c'est douter. Écrire, c'est hésiter. Écrire, c'est attendre. Écrire, c'est la main qui s'agite. Enfin, écrire, c'est les galopes qui donnent. Enfin, écrire, c'est les mots qui s'alignent, les phrases qui s'allonge. Écrire, c'est la feuille qui devient noire. Écrire, c'est des caractères, des mots comme des notes de musique sur une partition. Écrire, c'est de la musique. Écrire, c'est un rythme, une cadence, un mouvement, une mesure. Écrire, c'est des gâteaux, des galops qui galopent dans le crâne, leurs sabots qui tapent sur le bureau, leur queue qui fouette des idées. Écrire, c'est de l'adrénaline qui monte, le pouls qui s'accélère, la respiration en attente, une apnée. Écrire, c'est dire aux autres de vous foutre la paix, de se débrouiller pour manger, de commander une pizza. Écrire, c'est maintenant ou jamais, sinon ça passera, il faudra de nouveau attendre et de nouveau douter. Écrire, c'est un éclair, une brèche, une baffe. Écrire, c'est une transe, une extase, un délire alcaloïde. Écrire, c'est lire et se demander d'où viennent ces mots, de quel arrière-pays de la raison, de quel étage, de quel sous-sol. Écrire, c'est donner. Écrire, c'est reprendre le texte et ses esprits. Écrire, c'est la cadence, reprendre le galop. Tatatatum, 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 tatatatum. Écrire, c'est un train qui passe. Écrire, c'est être à bord de ce train et regarder par la fenêtre. Écrire, c'est le paysage qui défile et l'œil qui tente de capturer. Écrire, c'est peindre. Écrire, c'est pointilliste. Écrire, c'est jouir. Écrire, c'est jouir. Écrire, c'est jouir. Écrire, c'est jouir. Écrire, c'est le silence. Silence, silence. Écrire, c'est des taches, des ronds, des points de couleur. Écrire, c'est reprendre son souffle, soupirer, respirer. Écrire, c'est lire à voix haute des mots accouchés, lire à voix haute des phrases enfantées, dire. Écrire, c'est oser dire. Écrire, c'est parler. Écrire, c'est prononcer l'indicible. Exprimer l'exprimable, figurer le vide. Écrire, c'est oser la poésie. Et vivre.
And living.
Et vivre.
And living.
Et vivre.
I'm sorry, I need words.
And the last one. Poetry is useless. Don't you think so? La poésie ne sert à rien quand sonne le réveil strident, brutal, et qu'il faut te bouger ce corps et ce courage du lit à la douche, au café insipide, au garage, à la route, au bureau inutile. La poésie ne sert à rien.
When the alarm clock rings, strident, brutal, you should move your body and your courage out of bed to the shower, to the tasteless coffee, to the garage, to the road, to the boring office. Poetry is useless.
Quand tu déneiges ton palier, quand on te grille la priorité, quand on te raye ta voiture, quand tu renverses ton café, quand tu oublies, quand tu rates, quand te pressent les réunions, quand tombent les deadlines, quand tu oublies de passer prendre le pain et les enfants, la poésie ne sert à rien.
When you clear snow from your doorstep, when someone ignores your right of way, when someone scratches your car, when you spill your coffee, when you forget, when you miss, when meetings run, when deadlines fall, when you forget to take home bread and children, is poetry useless?
Quand partent les absents de nos mémoires vides, de nos images effacées par la distance, le temps et les soucis, quand leurs visages deviennent flous, vagues, pâles ou imprécis, la poésie sert-elle à quelque chose?
When the absent are leaving our memories clean from pictures, deleted by distances, weather and worries, when their faces become blurry, vague, pale or imprecise, is poetry useless?
Quand crache la télé du monde, les infamies, les guerres, les morts, les dictatures, les pleurs, la faim, la haine, le désespoir, la rage, l'horreur, la peine et les tortures, la poésie sert à quelque chose?
When the TV screams out of the world infamies, wars, death, dictatorships, fears, hunger, hatred, despair, fury, horror, sorrow, and tortures, poetry is useless.
Quand sonne le réveil, sifflant, jovial, et que tu te sais vivant, présent, debout, dans ton espace peuplé de gens, de sons et de souvenirs, la poésie sert.
When the alarm clock rings, whistling, jovial, and you know you are alive, present, standing up in your living space full of people, sounds, and memories, poetry helps.
Elle sert à savourer ton café, à te foutre des dates butoirs, médiocrité et autres impératifs. Elle t'entoure dans tes rires, tes pleurs et tes orgasmes. La poésie est un orgasme.
To enjoy your coffee, not to care about deadlines, mediocrities and other requirements. It surrounds you when you laugh, when you cry, when you come. Poetry is an orgasm.
It is. Thank you.